The reading is from Job chapter 19. You can find it on page 523 of the Church Bibles. And as you know, Job's friends have been around to see him, and in the chapter before, Bildad has spoken to Job. And then in chapter 19, we read, "Then Job replied, 'How long will you torment me and crush me with words? 10 times now you have reproached me. Shamelessly you attack me. If it is true that I have gone astray, my error remains my concern alone. If indeed you would exalt yourselves above me and use my humiliation against me, then know that God has wronged me and drawn his net around me. Though I cry, I've been wronged, I get no response. Though I call for help, there is no justice. He has blocked my way so that I cannot pass. He has shrouded my paths in darkness. He has stripped me of my honor and removed the crown from my head. He tears me down on every side till I'm gone. He uproots me, my hope, like a tree. His anger burns against me. He counts me among his enemies. His troops advance in force. They build a siege ramp against me and encamp around my tent. He has alienated my brothers from me. My acquaintances are completely estranged from me. My kinsmen have gone away. My friends have forgotten me. My guests and my maidservants count me a stranger. They look upon me as an alien. I summon my servant, but he does not answer. Though I beg him with my own mouth. My breath is offensive to my wife. I am loathsome to my own brothers. Even the little boys scorn me. When I appear, they ridicule me. All my intimate friends detest me. Those I love have turned against me. I am nothing but skin and bones. I have escaped by only the skin of my teeth. Have pity on me, my friends, have pity, for the hand of God has struck me. Why do you pursue me as God does? Will you never get enough of my flesh? Oh, that my words were recorded, that they were written on a scroll, that they were inscribed with an iron tool on lead or engraved in rock forever. I know that my Redeemer lives and that in the end he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes, I and not another. How my heart yearns within me. If you say, how we will hound him, since the root of the trouble lies in him, you should fear the sword yourselves. For wrath will bring punishment by the sword, and then you will know that there is judgment."
When I rang Darren, or emailed him and said about coming here, and we talked about what I would preach, and he told me you were doing Job, I thought, great! When you read through that chapter, was there, as we say, was there any, you know, in Bible studies you often say, was there a verse that really stood out to you in Job 19? Yeah. I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I will see him with my own eyes, I and not another. Now my heart yearns within me. And so we wrestled over who should preach this text. And I won, in inverted commas. And the reason I say in inverted commas is because Job, what kind of a book is Job? There we go. I'm going to try very quickly to show you maybe a different way of looking at the book of Job. It's certainly a different way of looking at the book of Job than I had anticipated when we first spoke. And so I hope it'll make sense to you. So here it says, Job, the book of the suffering servant who never asks to be healed and whose final vindication comes from God. The book of the suffering servant. So, if we just go back to the beginning, because the beginning is a good place to start, what we don't know about this book, we don't know where Uz is. Sounds a bit funny even to say it. We don't know the place that it was written. We don't really know when it was written. You can look and see that it quotes so much Davidic writings that most commentators put it around 750, no earlier, sort of 750 BC, but people don't know for sure. We don't know who wrote it. We don't know who the original author was, the audience was, and we don't know much about Job. There's nothing about Job's, you know, so often in the Tanakh and in the Torah, we know the person from their genealogy. Even with Jesus, even with Yeshua, we know him in Matthew's gospel from his genealogy. No genealogies here. So what do we know? I think we're going to be challenged by the character of Job. Because the Bible says that Job was blameless and upright, as he introduces him. It says it twice, in verse 1 and in verse 8. It said that Job feared God and shunned evil. And those are couplets. You're going to see right the way through Job, it's about pairs. You're going to see it in Job 19, that he fears God and shuns evil. It's two-dimensional, his relationship with God. And Job is described as the Lord's servant. So then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job?" This title of the Lord's servant is very obvious in the book of Isaiah, isn't it? He's described as a servant. We've got the servant songs. Isaiah 53 is the pinnacle of messianic prophecy for most people. And there is this suffering servant. And yet very often we don't think of as the book of Job as about a suffering servant. I think it's almost too frightening to think to think that simply about it. We know that in the story, Job was healthy, wealthy, and wise. You may or you won't have noticed, I don't imagine, that there were a series of tens. So he has seven sons and three daughters, and he has 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels. And he's got a picture of two tens. And 10 is how many fingers you've got on your hand, if you've suffered no mortal injuries or anything straight. So this is a picture of completeness. So he's got everything. And he's unique. "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one on earth like him. He's blameless and upright." The scriptures say he was blameless and upright. And this is a bit of a challenge for us theologically, isn't it? Do we not believe in original sin or the depravity of all mankind, of an inherited sinfulness? And yet scripture says that he was righteous. In fact, you can see he was an intercessory prayer. You know, he made sacrifices in case his family had sinned in their hearts. So it was no superficial relationship that he had, and he even felt the need to intercede for those in his family for their protection. Yeah. And yet, despite all of this, despite all of his righteousness, despite being described by God, God said to Satan, "There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." That's quite a character demonstration. And the reason I'm laboring the point about his character is because when you look at Job 19, you need to understand who's speaking. It's very important that in Old Testament to see who's speaking. So in the first two chapters, you have three dominant characters: Satan, Job, and the Lord. And Satan isn't mentioned after chapter 2. He's gone then. He's mentioned, I think, in Zechariah 3, and then not until the New Testament. So in the first two chapters, there are three characters: the Lord, Satan, and Job. Those are the dominant ones, repeated over and over again, and then they disappear until chapter 9. In chapter 3, we meet his three friends, and then there is a fourth friend who will appear later. And it's always a bit scary going into a book like this, so I took two friends to guide me. One is a guy called Francis Anderson, and the other is a man called Christopher Ashe. I don't have either of these books to sell you. This is a great book for somebody who doesn't like going through line by line and knowing what every Hebrew word means. And this is if you do like going through line by line and want to know what every Hebrew word means. And I'm guessing you could get this off the internet for £3 or £4, and I think it would be well. Either one would be a great investment to shove on your library because they're exciting books to read. So let me tell you what Mr. Anderson wants to say about the book of Job. He says, "The real and persistent problem, the real problem of the book, is not the problem of suffering to be solved intellectually by supplying a satisfactory answer which explains why it happened, but the attainment of a right relationship with God which makes existence in suffering holy and acceptable." He says the purpose of Job is not to solve the problem of why do good people suffer. That's not the purpose of it. He says it's trying to supply an answer which makes suffering holy and acceptable. Because Job's friends, their theology makes sense a lot of the time. You know, it's good things, if you're good. Their view of God is of a vending machine that you put coins of good in and out come blessings. And therefore, if cursings are coming out of your machine, it's because you're putting sin in at the top. And it's a very linear relationship. It's a very straightforward relationship between those two things. And Job is going to teach us quite the opposite. And he's going to take the book is going to take its time doing it. 42 chapters to explain it. And then before we get to the actual text, there's one little verse that I do want to read. What did Job want? In chapter 9, verse 32, he says, God, is not a man like me that I might answer him, that we might confront each other in court. If only there was someone to arbitrate between us, to lay his hands upon us both, someone to remove God's rod from me so that his terror would frighten me no more. Then I would speak up without fear of him. But as it now stands with me, I cannot. Job's hope is for somebody to remove God's rod from him. Can you hear the gospel in that? The punishment that should have been ours would be his. If you start to think of Isaiah 53 in the back of your mind as you're looking at these texts, you start to see more of the gospel in Job than maybe you would have done at first glance. He wants somebody to arbitrate between us, to mediate, to stand in between. And there's a picture here of his hands, somebody with his hands on both, on Job and of God. Job's theology is remarkable. It's not just his character, it's not just his behavior, it's not just his righteousness, because, you know, in all of this, Job did not sin. He says, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord taketh away, and his name will be praised. He says, regardless of what circumstance befall me, I will do that. And he didn't sin by charging God with wrongdoing. And later on, his wife says, are you still holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die. And he says, you're foolish. Shall I accept good and not trouble? So, what does Job 19 want to say to us? If you turn now to Job 19, it'll be really helpful for me. So, as Hugo rightly said, at first Job is replying to one of his friends. His friend has just said, surely such is the dwelling of an evil man, such is the place of one who knows not God. So this pastor, in need of a bit of training perhaps, has gone to Job and said, you must be a person who does not know God. Because in his theology, he cannot understand how Job could be in this situation. And so Job says, how long will you torment me and crush me with your words? 10 times now you have reproached me. Shamelessly you attack me. 10 times. So if you don't go back over the last text and try and find the 10 times he did it, see that 10 is a picture of completion, just as it was a picture of completion in verse 1 of the very beginning of the book. Look at the words he's using. Torment, crush, reproach, and attack. And then he says something really critical. If it is true that I have gone astray, my error remains my concern alone. Job is pushing everything else aside and putting all his hope in his relationship with God. I think it was whoever was praying, you know, we prayed for to have our minds kind of, all the distractions of the world to go away. Job, no wonder God described Job as unique. He was so focused on the Lord. He has one last critical thing to say about his friends. If indeed you'll exalt yourself above me and use my humiliation against me, then know that God has wronged me and drawn his net around me. He's not accusing God of wrongdoing here. He's accusing them of wrong theology. He's showing them that they've taken what it's basically not human, what the way that they're treating him. They're taking a man who's already humiliated, who is already afflicted, who is already so detestable that people would cross the street to avoid him. They're taking a man in that situation and they're making matters worse. They're using his humiliation as a way to exalt themselves. And again, that picture, that's a picture that Paul uses to say that, you know, when he talks about Jesus disarming all authority by his public humiliation on the cross. The word God has wronged in verse 6 has the meaning of turned upside down or dealt perversely or overthrown or subverted. If Job feels that God has wronged him, what he feels is not that God has done something wrong, but that God has turned everything he understands upside down. And that, I would say that would be my experience of encountering God. That for 39 years, I thought I knew how the world worked, how things functioned, what was right, what was wrong. Most of the people that we meet in the street say, I'm a good person, I don't need to go to church to know that I'm a good person. Only a good person goes to church, so I'm not really that kind of, I'm not really into that. Job knows. Job is honest, really, isn't he? He's honest about how he feels about his circumstance. He feels overthrown and turned upside down. And it is a challenge. He gets no response, no help, and no justice. In verse 7, though I cry, I've been wronged, I get no response from God. Though I call to God for help, there is no justice. Job gives us a picture of the right way to behave when we call to God and he appears not to answer. We know what's going on, so we know that Job is righteous, and yet here God's not answering his calls. And then from verse 8 to verse 12, he uses these pairs. He talks about God blocking him and shrouding him from the way forward. He strips Job of his honor in verse 9. He removes his crown from his head. He tears him down, sort of tears him down from above and uproots him from below. He burns against him and he counts him amongst his enemies. His troops advance in force and they build a siege ramp. They're all parallels. So with this one in verse 12, it's like a big army. He says it's like a big army going marching out and defeat me. But it's also like an army going around, putting a siege round me. It's every imaginable negative. And then from verse 13 to verse 19, he then moves on from what has happened to what God has done directly to him to the consequences of what God has done. So he finds himself alienated and estranged from his family and friends. His kinsmen, his family have gone away and forgotten him. His guests and his maidservants count him as a stranger and they look upon him as an alien. Even when he calls for his servant, they don't come. He has to beg his servant to come. And then perhaps the most painful thing for anybody who's married, my breath is offensive to my wife. I'm loathsome to my own brothers. If your breath is offensive to your wife, you have to be quite close to her at the time for her to know that. And if you are fortunate enough to be married, and you know, if you can just visualize that, sometimes, just imagine what it would be like when you got close to your wife, that her reaction towards you was that you were just disgusting. And Job is telling us that this is the situation that God has created for him. All my intimate friends detest me, and the ones I love have turned from me. I'm nothing but skin and bones. I've escaped only by the skin of my teeth. Here's the first bit of Hebrew problem. That the idea of Job has not escaped by the skin of his teeth. That's how we use, that's the English phrase. If you escape by the skin of your teeth, you just about get away with it. Well, Job hasn't got away with it, has he? So you've got to question whether that's a helpful translation. You know, the Bible translators use all sorts of words like difficult, ambiguous, unclear. You know, and when those experts are using those phrases, then you've got to be cautious. The closest translation that I like, and you can look up, there are lots and lots of different versions, but there's a picture of him without any teeth. He's lost his grip. And that, I think, is probably, for me, that's the closest thing. He's got to the point where he feels like he's lost his grip. He's in despair. Then he says, "Why do you pursue me as God does?" To his friends he speaks. "Why do you pursue me as God does? Will you never get enough of my flesh?" Think about what his flesh was at that point. It wasn't very attractive. It's like, I've got nothing to offer you, but you're still tearing at me. And then he says, "Oh, that my words were recorded, that they were written on a scroll, that they were inscribed with an iron tool on lead or engraved in a rock forever." See how there's a progression with the thinking? This is, again, there's a rhythm of three here, of the words being recorded. No, better than recording them, let's write them down. No, it's better than writing them down on a piece of metal, which would be good, let's write them on stone. It's increasingly written, the length of time is increased and increased and increased. And then he makes the statement, "I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end he will stand upon the earth." Redeemer. The idea of a redeemer in the Hebrew thinking is like a kinsman redeemer, the idea of Boaz and Ruth. So this redeemer, this is about a relationship. He's talking about someone who's going to save him, but it's somebody who's coming to save him who's related to him. And it runs in direct contrast to that big sweep of everything being taken away from him. He's saying, these are my circumstances, I can't understand them, but in the end, my hope is going to be in my Redeemer. And that in the end, he will stand upon the earth. After my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see him. I myself will see him with my own eyes. Three times he emphasizes that he's going to see him. Job believes that somehow, some way or other, he's going to see God. In the same way that Abraham saw God. He saw the Lord and Moses saw the Lord. Moses went to the top of the mountain and had a big banquet with him and the 70 elders. Moses also saw God standing in the flames of the burning bush. And Job's hope is the same, that he will see with his eyes. And he says, "How my heart yearns within me." It's the translation of it is something like, "My kidneys rise up into my chest." That's what it literally means. In a way, I'm tempted to look back at that the word wronged and say, it turns me upside down. You know, how do I make sense? My heart yearns within me is a reasonable translation, but it doesn't get to the real guttural nature of it. And then finally, in the final section, he says, "If you say, how we will hound him, since the root of the trouble lies in him, you should fear the sword yourselves, for the wrath will bring punishment by the sword, and then you will know that there is judgment." So Job began by correcting his friends. "How long will you torment me and crush me with words?" And his speech ends warning his friends and pointing towards judgment. So he ends by saying, "Look, you're saying that my trouble lies at the heart of me." Job's position, as he states over and over again, is If I've wronged God, that's my concern and my concern alone. But he's such an amazing character because his concern is for his friends. He's pointing them to resurrection and judgment day, and he's saying, you fear for yourselves. You see my situation, but I know that I'm a man of integrity. I know that when God appears, I will be justified. I cannot say the same for you. And so he calls them to make sure they're in a right standing with God. It's a very Jesus on the cross-like situation. And so the thing with wisdom literature and with poetry is it doesn't give you a simple answer. People will approach you and say to you, how can you believe in God? Oh, well, blah, 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 blah. And they will say to you, well, if there's so much suffering in the world, how can there be God? How can there be a good God? And you will feel about that big at this point, because their simple question, we don't have a simple answer to. And Job teaches us, evangelistically, Job teaches us not to go for the simple answer. Ultimately, a relationship with God is what's going to make sense of all suffering. Ultimately, our God is the one who paid the ultimate price in order that that relationship should be one of forgiveness. We're the forgiven children of God, eternally forgiven. So as you read through Job 19 and you see his focus and his hope, and you think, hurrah, I can see clearly the idea that God's going to come down to earth and we're going to see him walking around. You can see that, but beware that you're taking what you know and you're looking backwards and you're seeing it in the text that way. And just take it, if you take the time to see what Job saw, then you begin to look at it slightly differently, and then it's real, it's ground-based wisdom. You can, if you are anything like me, you will have at times felt that God has wronged you. You will have at times felt that he has blocked your path or stripped you of your honor. And as you feel like that, you can feel like running from him. But Job gives us the opposite picture. That though you may feel like that, ultimately your vindication is going to come from God. So, what does Job want from us today? He wants us to be people of integrity. That's the central issue. Job is not a man who just does what God says because God has blessed him. He says, whether God gives me or takes away, I'm going to be the same. I'm still going to praise him. And Paul says that whether I'm in good circumstances or bad, well-fed or hungry, I'm still going to pursue God. So it's no different Old Testament, New Testament. Please, please recognize that sin and suffering are not linked in a linear relationship. God is not a slot machine that you can feed in good works and get out blessings. In fact, my experience in the short 8 years that I've been a believer is that as soon as you start thinking that pushing in blessings up the good works at the top will bring out blessings at the bottom, it stops. It's not that simple. And if somebody wants to talk to you about suffering, if they genuinely do, then you just need to listen. Embrace wisdom and trust God and be comforters. The comfort that we've received, we're to share with others. And lastly, to seek all the answers in our relationship with God. Job didn't ask to be healed. He asked God to vindicate him and to give him an understanding of why he was suffering. If we can be people who suffer and hope, then the gospel will become clear in our lives. maybe not to us at the in that moment, but to the people that are surrounding us. And that people will be drawn to this God who went to the ultimate. He went to the ultimate in order that we might live. He died for us that we might live. Not just for now, but in eternity. And so we will see our Redeemer. We should have much more confidence than Job had. We know we will see him. We have been given that promise, and that promise should change our lives. The promise of resurrection should change our lives.